The sixth case for today, Comber v. Cooperative Plus.
It pleases the court. My name is Carl Szymanski, and I represent the appellant, James Ciomber. This case originated in the state court of Boone County, state of Illinois. Mr. Ciomber alleged negligence on behalf of the appellee, who is a distributor of propane gas. He alleges that CPI, the defendant or appellee below, delivered an ultra-hazardous substance to his home and continued to do so despite their knowledge of an existing leak for quite some time before his house exploded. There's evidence within this record that a CPI employee who tested this gas system in Ciomber's home after certain portions of it were replaced detected a leak within the system. Ciomber continued to complain of an odor of gas as he had before the components of the gas system had been replaced. CPI never shut off the gas to his home until after it exploded. On November 17th of 2001, Ciomber moved the dryer in his home. On November 18th, the house exploded. We've asserted four errors by the district court, which are summarized as follows. First, that they improperly granted a summary judgment because the items to be considered in a response under Rule 56, some of which constitute judicial admissions, clearly show that a material issue of fact exists in this case. Second, that the court erred in determining that expert testimony is required to prove the element of causation in this particular case when causation was judicially admitted through the answer filed by the defendant in this case and request for admissions that they had made.
So then
if it went back to the district court, is that how you would prove causation? Because that was my question. How would you prove causation without the expert?
I can prove causation two different ways in this particular case. Number one, by the answer to the complaint and the responses to the request for admissions, the cumulative effect of those. And number two, the issue of causation here, I think, became confused in the court below. Because we have to look, and I'll try lengthy a way to answer your question. The elements of this tort are set forth in the Adams and Clare cases decided by the Illinois Supreme Court. Standard law school torts, duty violation, cause, and damages. However, the duty set forth by the Illinois Supreme Court is that the gas company, when they're on notice of a leak, make sure that it's fixed, and if it's not, shut off the gas to prevent exactly this type of calamity.
But if the calamity happened, if it happened because the gas dryer was moved, and that could have disconnected the tank, the pipe that brings the gas into the house, then you don't have a case, do you?
There's not one scintilla of evidence in this case that moving the dryer caused any leak of gas in this house. And on this issue, which is summary judgment being granted, we review this for an issue of fact. That gets us back to the district court.
But you can't prove this case without an expert witness.
Mm-hmm. No. No, I disagree.
You think it's res ipsa or something?
The elements are that the plaintiff must prove notice on the part of the gas company that there was a leak, and that having had that notice, that the gas company failed to either correct the leak, warn the defendant, or shut off the gas. So the failure to warn, the failure to shut off the gas, was the cause of the damage to the plaintiff.
Give me the timing again between the the complaint of a gas leak, but they came out and investigated.
The original complaints of gas leaks go back 18 years.
Sure.
Okay? And then, as a result of all the gas leaks, CPI replaced the tank and line supplying gas to the home. When that system was tested by the CPI employee, he found that there was a loss of pressure inside the house, which indicates there's still a gas leak inside the residence. CPI continued after that time, which, although they don't have the records of replacing the tank, we can fairly estimate was sometime in August of 2000. And based on that, there has been a leak in that house since August of 2000 all the way to November of 2001.
When was the gas dryer moved in relation to the explosion?
It was moved on the 17th.
So a day before?
Yes. But since this is summary judgment, the court has to give all inferences of fact in our favor.
But that just underscores for me the importance of an expert witness that's going to establish a triable issue of fact on what the source of the leak was that caused the explosion.
Adams doesn't require proof of the source of the leak. The liability is imposed on this person who supplies this ultra-hazardous product because they knew of the leak, they knew of the potential damage, and their duty was to turn it off.
But you agreed, I mean, I'm beating a dead horse here, but you agree that if it's established that you move a gas dryer and that ruptures the tank, ruptures the supply line, which apparently could happen. If that is the cause of the explosion, then there's no liability on the gas company.
It's a concurring cause between the pre-existing leak and any speculative leak caused by moving the dryer. But his testimony is he moved the dryer in accordance with the manner that he saw a prior service person move it by opening the door and pulling on the inside of the dryer drum. And then he slid it back. He also testified that there was no increase in the odor of gas from the time he moved the dryer until the time the house exploded. So all the facts work against the defendant in this particular case. They don't have anything that they can point to or anybody can adopt as a position that there was a leak caused by moving the dryer. There's no evidence in the case that happened. It's pure speculation and an improper inference granted by the district court that says that the defendant was entitled to summary judgment in this case.
How did that come to light, by the way?
What?
That the gas dryer was moved.
There was a police report by a deputy sheriff where Siamber explained what had occurred prior to that. Okay. The one other issue that I'd like to address briefly is that the court abused its discretion in barring the entire testimony of the plaintiff's expert as a sanction for alleged violations of Rule 26A2. In that particular situation, the court needs to consider on an abuse of discretion standard whether there was prejudice or surprise, whether there's an ability to cure the defect, whether the likelihood was that it would disrupt the trial, and whether there was any bad faith or willfulness on the part of counsel in making the 26A2 disclosure. We submit that the court had options available to it, that the taking of the deposition resulted in no prejudice to the defendant. They had asserted one time prior that they were going to take the deposition of the expert witness. And in fact, when I took the deposition of the expert, we paid the expert's fee. We provided a transcript to the defense counsel when we filed our motion, our response for the motion for summary judgment. So it resulted in no cost other than that what they would have had they taken his deposition on their own. They still would have had the attorney time involved. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Dom?
If it pleases the court, my name is Dave Dalma. I represent Appellee Cooperative Plus, Inc., who I'll often refer to as CPI. I'd like to kind of pick up where Mr. Szymanski left off, which is really what I see are the two pure legal issues on appeal here. One is the district court's decision to exclude the expert testimony based on the gross deficiencies in the plaintiff's 26A2 report, And then the second legal issue is the court's grant of summary judgment when it accepted our premise, which I'll discuss under Adams as proper, that expert testimony is required for them to prove their case in chief where their sole theory of liability is negligence. But let's talk about the judge's decision to exclude the evidence. Here's the timeline. After some extensions, and I don't need to get into the minutia of why these extensions were granted, but the bottom line is that the magistrate at the lower, at the district court level, set a deadline of October 31, 2005, for them to produce a Rule 26A expert disclosure. The record shows that on October 28th, the plaintiff's counsel, the appellant's counsel, received a fax from, at that point, his sole liability expert, which in the record, for your reference, is BA32-34. That record ultimately, or that fax ultimately was what their disclosure was. Unfortunately, Mr. Szymanski suffered a heart attack on October 30th and October 31. His wife dictated something to the effect of, we need an extension of time to file the disclosure. But the fact of the matter is, this case has been pending for over 20 months before the heart attack, and they had the plaintiff's expert's disclosure in their hands. At a subsequent conference on the hearing, in light of his health conditions, the district court said, you know what, you've got another 7 days to supplement this. And his law partner acknowledged that she could or would supplement the disclosure that they had made. January 31, 2006, approximately 3 months later, we bring our motion for summary judgment. Prior to that, the appellant had made no attempt to supplement the Rule 26 disclosure, and a close reading of their brief at the district court level and at this level shows that up until their reply brief in this case, they've never attempted to defend the sufficiency of the disclosure. And even a cursory reading of that report shows that it's wholly inadequate, and under this court's decision in Salgado and the other jurisprudence of this court, that it fails to even come close to complying with the substantive requirements of Rule 26A2. So then the question becomes, what is the court's inherent jurisdiction, which this court has made very clear? Rule 37, in light of Rule 26A2, when the disclosures are wholly insufficient, can be almost viewed as self-executing. The idea is, we as the other side have a right for them to put their expert cards on the table. I don't necessarily need to take their expert's deposition. I've been involved in a lot of cases in federal court where when I get a sufficiently detailed expert report, I may go and try and get deposition transcripts. I may do other attorney decisions, but I don't necessarily need to take their deposition if it's a fully disclosed, adequate report. In this case, it fell far short. As soon as we got the report, we made the motion for summary judgment. That's reviewed by this that decision by the district court is reviewed by this court on abuse of discretion, and I don't think there's any question, A, that the report fell far short, B, that they've offered no reason or substantial justification for any effort to try and supplement the report between November of 2005 and when we brought our motion. And in fact, what the appellant did was then note the deposition of its own expert and say, well, that will supplement our report. And that issue came up in front of a proceeding in front of the magistrate on March 10, 2006. And at that point, our motion for summary judgment was pending. And the magistrate made it very clear, and I'll refer to the court to the appendix, the long appendix filed by the appellant. At page A79, where the magistrate clearly informed the appellant, but counsel, this expert, the one that wrote the disclosure, is an expert you have under your control. This is an expert that you should have had ready to go as far as any response in a motion for summary judgment. I'm not going to wait for you to take the deposition. I'm not going to wait for you to get the transcript. If you want to add something from the expert as far as the affidavit is concerned, you should have that up and ready to go. Mr. Szymanski, okay, I'll get that. Well, that didn't happen. What the appellant did was ultimately take the deposition of his own expert, at our cost to fly down from Minneapolis as lead counsel to Illinois to attend the deposition with this scant report that provided us with barely any information other than bases for opinions that included things like review of depositions, quote-unquote engineering judgment, gave us no specific information that tied our client's acts or omissions to the events that led to the explosion, particularly in light of the fact that it had been well known since day one of this case that our defense was he moved the dryer on the day of the explosion, that's what caused the leak. Mr. Szymanski, appellant's counsel.
Do you have an expert witness?
We do. And we properly made disclosures that it was the movement of the dryer. Their expert opinion, for its lack of any real connection between the facts of the case, let alone industry standards or the National Fuel Gas Code, other things that would apply to this case, their theory of the case was that the leak originated in the basement. So when to say there's no scintilla of evidence relating to the acts on the day before the explosion is inaccurate. But my point simply is their response to a wholly insufficient report was to note the deposition of their own expert, were put on notice by the magistrate judge. That's independent of this court's determination of the pending motion for summary judgment, and they never even took the trouble to file an expert affidavit in connection with opposing our motion for summary judgment to create an issue of material facts.
So when you even showed up at this deposition, what you had in hand was this scant expert report. Really didn't know what this expert was going to say, and so you weren't even in a position to question the expert. I assume you didn't.
That's right, Your Honor. At BA 32 through 34, and by way of example, the gas supplier, CPI, this is opinion 6, did not inspect or leak test the system properly during several years of complaints by Mr. Siomber. Basis for the opinion, depositions, industry standards, NFPA 54 and 58, which are National Fuel Gas Code standards. And he goes on to talk about CPI policies. Well, I'm sorry, but that doesn't tell me in any reasonable form, well, what provisions of CPI, what industry standards, what's the ordinary standard of care in the industry based on these alleged facts in the complaint? What deposition testimony of our employees, of Mr. Siomber? None of that's there. And their position is, well, you had a chance to come down and take his deposition, and then it was continued because his schedule, expert schedule, didn't permit, and so then you got a chance to review the transcript a little bit more before you came down again. So on the issue of did the district court abuse its discretion in barring the expert from testifying, I think the answer is clearly no, which leads to the second question, which is, absent expert testimony, is there an issue of triable fact in this case? And that gets me, I think, to the Adams case. And I think there's some important points about the Adams case. The Adams case stands for a lot of different propositions about the duties, the general duties of someone who supplies gas. Adams was about a public utility who happened to supply natural gas. But there's certain statements in Adams that apply to issues in this case. What I'd like to direct the court's attention to is if you look at Adams closely, and I'm citing to 809 Northeast 2nd at 1260, Adam talks a lot about a lot of different common law duties, but it goes on, and I'm sorry, at 12, at 1260, it says, circumstances may be such as to require a gas company to investigate immediately and shut off the gas supply until repairs are made. The nature of the notice may also affect the extent of the inspection necessary. That's another way of saying, in my understanding, you're going to need somebody to talk about what the nature of the notice is and link that nature of the notice to what the gas company should or shouldn't have done under its standard of care. The last point I'd like to make, which I can't overemphasize, with Adams at page 16, it says, and this is at 1263, We repeat plaintiff's clarification and oral argument that defendant gas company's duty of reasonable care in this case consists only of warning and not inspection. We express no opinion as to the adequacy of the defendant's conduct in this case. What they're saying is, after a lengthy discussion about what this defendant and Adams knew about a very dangerous situation involving Cobra gas connectors, knowing that many of its customers' homes had been involved in explosions involving these gas detectors, the Adams court didn't make the jump that the appellant wants you to make, which is, well, that's the end of it. This is a matter of common sense. I don't need expert testimony. The Adams court essentially said this is still a negligence case, and in a negligence case, you need admissible expert testimony to establish the standard of care and, most importantly, causation.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
So right off the top, counsel, why don't you explain why you didn't file a supplemental affidavit after the expert's deposition was taken by you, or file any kind of papers to supplement the initial report that you filed?
I filed the transcript of the expert's deposition.
I understand that, but he's entitled to have it, your theory and what the expert is going to say, totally laid out.
Let me correct a little bit of a misstatement which I hear concerning the facts of this case. The expert's deposition was noticed. It was taken at my office on March 13th.
Right. Transcript and isn't a normal procedure that a full expert report is disclosed to counsel in advance of the deposition be taken so counsel can be prepared?
However, half of the deposition was taken on the 13th. I concluded my questioning. I provided defense counsel with a full transcript of everything the witness had said. He had every exhibit that was referred to in the deposition, and he had 3 weeks to prepare to cross-examine him when he took the second half of the deposition.
So when he refers to industry standards and very specific things, were those identified in the deposition? Were those industry standards spelled out? Were those policies of CPI spelled out in the testimony?
Absolutely. They completely cross-examined him on every issue of his testimony and had 3 weeks to prepare for it with a full transcript of his testimony that was given to them for free, that provided every document that he testified to. They had 3 weeks to get ready to take this deposition. They didn't ask him questions the first day on the 13th when that portion of the transcript was filed with the court, the deadline for us to answer the summary judgment motion. 3 weeks later, if you look at the record, you'll see that Minnesuski's deposition was taken in two sections. And the second section, they had everything for 3 weeks prior to that deposition. And if I may, Your Honor, I see that my time is up.
I'll give you another minute or two.
Thank you. I'd like to note, and it's very important in this case, if you look at their request for admissions and you look at their answer to the complaint, they've admitted causation in this case. I shouldn't have to prove it. Those are judicial admissions which should have that full effect. This is not Salgado. There's been no finding of willfulness. There has been no finding of anything that I did wrong as far as deadlines. Every deadline in this case for experts, the first one was set, the very first one, and that's why I provided every one of the transcripts of every proceeding in front of the magistrate. The first expert deadline was set on April 27th, which because of a scheduling error, I was not in court. I responded to that. I requested that we set out the deadlines necessarily because there was still some discovery to be done. Some of these discovery deadlines were extended by the fact that the defendant dumped 836 pages of documents that were due under 26A1 at the beginning of this case on me 8 months into the case right before the discovery deadlines ended. And that's why the judge was extending discovery deadlines. So when we extended the expert disclosure deadline after the 27th, that one, the next extension, was because of an office flood, where a hot water heater above our office destroyed our office and shut us down for 3 weeks. The next one was a request because I wanted to have the signed transcript of one of their employees to give to the expert. The magistrate judge extended it for that. Then I had a cardiac arrest at home. The judge gave us 7 days, and I got out of the hospital probably the day before that deadline ended. Now, is any of that willful? Hardly. Is any of that show bad faith on my part? Hardly. Where is the harm suffered by the defendant in this case? They had better than an expert report when his deposition was taken. They had a full transcript with every document and every question that I had asked him to work with to take his deposition. They have complete and full disclosure, and it is an abuse of discretion to just strike this witness completely when, in fact, there is no harm or prejudice to this defendant. They haven't demonstrated it. They haven't stood here and told you this is the harm we suffered, because there was none. They came to take the deposition. They would have come to take the deposition anyway. The April 27th extension of the discovery deadlines, one of the reasons that they asserted for wanting an extra week was that we want to take their expert's deposition. Now, all of a sudden, they don't want to take it, and they're harmed because I take it. It doesn't make sense.
Thank you, counsel.
We request that you reverse the summary judgment and remand it back to the district court. Thank you.